Sometimes we put our rock legends on pedestals. Michael Jackson, Frank Sinatra, Kurt Cobain. This is an excerpt from Andrew Altschul's Lady Lazarus. What happens when our heroes aren't really as heroic as they seem? We start with an introduction by the author.
Lady Lazarus is a novel that focuses on the character of Calliope Byrd Morath, who is a modern-day confessional poet, and she's also the daughter of two colossally famous rock stars, Brant Morath, who achieved tremendous universal fame with his band Terrible Children in the early 90s before flaming out and dying by suicide when Calliope was an infant. And her mother, Penny Power, who was the founder and leader of another punk band called Fuck Finn, but who, after her husband's death, became something of a recluse. The novel mostly focuses on Calliope, with a lot of attention on the story of her father's career and also his decline and death. Much of the novel is narrated by a music journalist who's trying to write Calliope's biography and doing a very bad job of it, and his name is Andrew Altschul. But some of the novel is narrated by Calliope herself, specifically when she's talking about her parents. And while the focus of the novel and much of the media attention was always on her father, one of the things Calliope wants to do is make sure that her mother's story is also told. So here's a section where she is trying to reclaim the spotlight that her mother lost when she was eclipsed by Brant's death. "And what of my suffering mother? You must want to know about her, Penny Power the bereaved, Penny the terrifying, Penny the aggrieved. No account would be complete without a close-up of her face. Picture poor Penelope, trapped in the Ithaca of her rock and roll fantasy, waiting stone-faced for an impossible return. And I, a pathetic Telemachus, bloodied at my father's hand, had no gift to ease her days, not a single consolatory word. Who was left to watch over her? Who would hold her elbow, shrieve her soul? Who'd lift the albatross from her shoulders, the collateral damage from a vagrant's undiscriminating bow? Yes, you've seen her on your television, you've seen her in your fashion magazines, but they can't tell of the long vigil on the windy widow's walk, the distant sliver of ocean on which she rested her bloodshot hopes. They don't convey the babble of lawyers and VPs, police, producers and debtors, the deluge of claims against him, the groupies who swore to God they'd bedded him and were carrying his true heirs, the bonds against cancellation in Oslo, Krakow, Sydney, Rotterdam, the dealers with cocaine noses, the skinny-tied Shylocks demanding their pound of meat, 108 suitors with pens and tape recorders hurling themselves into her moat. What would you have had her do, O disapproving one? Don her best sari, make herself pretty, lie down at his side in useless punk rock sooty? Then you don't know my mother." You think you've seen her, do you? You think that what you read is true, that the photos with Hefner, with Bono and Keitel, the mugshots and gold records can explain this Belle in all her complexity? At long last, sir, have you no sense of your own gullibility? Are you interested in what really is? Would you like to try a little quiz? True or false, she was born in Detroit in the summer of love, illegitimate offspring of a groupie and the drummer of the MC5. False, you fool. You're already failing. They made that one up for the liner notes of Fuck Finn's first EP. Not bad for a couple of girls with no marketing degree. Number two, are you still having fun? Her mother never told her the secret of her paternity, saving that factoid for the night of her sweet 16. She spent her adolescence praying to the gods of rock, Iggy and the Stooges, the Dolls, the Thin White Duke, and yes, the Motor City's dissonant quintet, all adorned her walls, watched over her restless futon nights, her backstage dreams, her slippery thighs, until the night of her birthday, when a leather-clad Leviathan stepped through the front door. "Your father," said Grandma. And my mother just gaped. She recognized his face from the poster above her bed, the curled lip and the dark eyes that had presided over her sweaty fantasies. Daughter, he smiled, and Penelope fled. She packed a bag, smashed her piggy bank. By sunrise, she'd made it to Chicago. By the next night, Cedar Falls. She hitchhiked her way to her West Coast destiny, holing up at a New Mexico nunnery before arriving at the beach with only the clothes on her back. Well, this story, you say, has got to be true. It fits so well with the face, the songs. It has its own logic. How could it be wrong? Ah, but it is, despite your surprise. Sorry to tell you, bub, you're 0 for 2. What about the speed addiction, the psychotic episode, the year in juvenile detention? Strikes 3, 4, and 5, you're out, and then some. Surely she had an affair with Kim Gordon. That's how she learned to play bass. Surely she lived in a Tijuana brothel, charging 50 pesos just to look at her face? No, and no again, mon cher. Really, I'm surprised. Can't you tell when you're being conned, when the machine is manufacturing a star right before your eyes? Listen closely, if you choose. I'll whisper in your ear. She grew up in New Jersey. Middle-class suburbs, braces, JV tennis, the whole bit. Daddy's little favorite, groomed for the Ivy League, stealing off to New York on school nights to hear Blondie and the Ramones, smoking pot in Washington Square with her giggling girlfriends, then off to Yale, where she majored in drama, had her first real boyfriend, a doctor's son from Brookline. My friends, am I boring you yet? Penny could have gone on to do anything, law school, med school, family connections on Broadway, but Mousy Penelope bought a ticket with her graduation check, and when the plane landed in San Diego, outstepped Penny Power, parentless miracle of self-invention, a fright to behold. Oh, my beautiful Gorgon, how you blazed a trail through the beach clubs and the biker bars, walked the streets with a bass strapped to your back, singing your tentative first songs while sitting on some Hell's Angel's lap. Shameless, they called you. And maybe you were, strutting around in a bikini, showing off your assets to the frat boys on Pacific Beach, inviting them to your coffeehouse gigs with a bat of your eyelashes and a cock of your hips. They came by the hundreds to the interchange, to Ground Zero, to Java Joe's, tiny rooms overflowing for every acoustic Thursday show. Aha, you think, my vigilant one, now this is the Penny I love and know. She'd start out sweetly, just a girl and her axe, her voice a melancholy whisper over the thrum and the slap, building and deepening, drawing the room in as she stood from her stool and bared her teeth, a howl that seemed to come from somewhere else, a dark planet called pain. Soon she was flat on her back, thrusting her hips, writhing across the stage. Everyone was paralyzed, swept up and whirling in the funnel cloud of her rage. Week after week, they watched her pour out her fury, mesmerized by her spotlit catharses. Red-faced, wailing, she rubbed her fingers raw on the strings. In the front row, they could feel the heat radiating from her body, the waves of desperation when she stepped up to the mic to sing. And though she was beautiful, everyone said so, tall and raven-haired, gray eyes, a model's proud bearing. They all felt they knew her. They felt she was speaking to their most private, aching fears when she sang what would become her anthem, a little ditty you might have heard called Ugly Like Me. We're going to transform the world, she told the slack-jawed crowd. Her set finished, she stood dripping in sweat, t-shirt torn and sticking to her chest, her face streaked with tears. The hushed room trembled in joy and a palpable terror that the soul-splitting howl they'd been holding inside might find its way out now, that this self-loathing they'd carried around might one day prove the mark of their worth. You don't believe me, said Teenex erstwhile most likely to, the victim of a profound, hollowing grief. But it's all going to turn upside down. People like us can be happy, my mother said. People like you and me are allowed to be happy. Then she hid her face in her hands and sobbed, her shoulders heaving, reflections from her bass shooting prisms of light over mute faces. Every boy and girl, every man and woman in that room wanted to put their arms around her and take her home. But who's that skinny kid, crushed against the back wall, his weak heart pounding with love? He would go to her now if he weren't frightened to death, pinned by the elbows of the newly converted. Who is that unshaved waif, waiting for a signal all these years, singing his songs to the homeless and the bent, cutting his skin with X-Acto knives? Imagine the shock when my father saw his own reflection. Imagine what went through his head as she looked up and hiccuped the manifesto of the new revolution. Fuck the beautiful, she said. Well, my astute little punk devotee, you think you know all the rest. How she found three more losers and called them Fuck Finn. How they sailed across the San Diego skies and landed at the top of the Casbah heap, the local record companies squabbling over the EP. How she finally did meet Brandt in the back room one night, 2 years after he'd first laid eyes on her. How they married 6 months later, her belly not yet swelling, the car crash in Ensenada on the way to their honeymoon. Steadily, they waged war on the mainstream, my mother, always the brains and the drive, working her contacts, seducing booking agents, buttonholing producers and critics alike. Where would he have been without her, that shy kid with his soggy bedroll, that angelic delinquent with his pocket Rembo? When self-doubt overcame him and he reached for a drink, who would smooth his forehead, kiss his eyelids? Who rubbed his tired shoulders and lit his cigarette? When his lyrics rang trite, chord progressions stillborn, who picked up the guitar and said, let's try B flat? Dirt Nap, Kill the Surfers, even Thorazine Days, his best songs might have never been written without her intervention. She had a dream, she could see the future, and nothing was going to prevent its realization, not even herself. No one will ever know what your love and belief mean to me, my father muttered into the microphone at the MTV Awards. Fidgeting like a fifth grader in a pink tuxedo, his bandmates jostling each other behind him, the girls in the audience shrieking on cue. You could hear the quaver in his quiet words. The crowd sucked in their breath as he held the best new group trophy over his head and said, Penny, this is for you. So don't you dare tell me she coasted on his fame. Don't purse your lips, don't shrug your shoulders and belittle her good name. Stalker, barnacle, starf. Yoko, she heard it all over the years, but not once did she waver from the course they'd laid. Not for a moment did she doubt their ambitions or underestimate the price that would have to be paid. Can you imagine what she did for him? The excuses she made up, the distractions she provided, the shortcomings and the drugs that she hid for him? When he was picked up in Pittsburgh, who took the rap? When he wanted to fire their first manager, who made the tough phone call? Who let fall the axe? Weeks that she didn't see him, sent people out to the fishing pier, to the fleabag motels to make sure he was still alive. The long nights in our house when she waited for him to come to bed, found him passed out in the studio in a puddle of vomit. She bathed his face, gently pulled the needle from the vein, and in the morning she brought him black coffee and a bottle of Xanax to soothe over the burn. Who do you think revived him in Mexico City that time? The largest free concert ever held in Chapultepec Park, that triumphant kickoff of the Terrible Children's World Tour, the moment sweet San Diego boy became a global wonder. But long after midnight in the Four Seasons Hotel, she woke up with a start, the rising star next to her rigid and bluing. She knew without thinking what had happened. She knew there was no time to lose. She dragged him to the bathtub, ran the water deathly cold, slapped him and pounded his back, parted his lips and blew air into his lungs, the clock ticking, ticking. And then she climbed into the water on top of him and squeezed his body to hers. She started to pray, babbling to a god of whom she'd never asked a thing before. There was a shiver, a cough, his glazed eyes fluttered open. It's fucking cold, he groaned at last, his lips trembling, but slowly pinking. My indomitable mother took his chin in her hand. You won't escape me that easily, Brandt, she said. We started something, and we're going to finish it.
Andrew Altschul is a Jones lecturer at Stanford. His newest novel, Lady Lazarus, is on sale now.